This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the new film A Scanner Darkly, based on the novel by science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, Robert Downey Jr. plays a dealer who traffics in Substance D, a lethally addictive drug which causes overpowering paranoid hallucinations.
I heard you have to go cold turkey.
Cold turkey doesn't even apply to Substance D. Unlike the legacy of inherited predisposition to addictive behavior or substances, this needs no genetic assistance. There's no weekend warriors on the D. You're either on it or you haven't tried it.
Well, I like it.
Yeah. How many caps do you take per day?
It's very difficult to determine, but not that many.
Well, like the old school pharmacopoeia, tolerance develops. You know, these visions of bugs, they're just garden variety psychosis, but a clear indication that you've hurtled over the initial fun and euphoric phase and passed on to the next phase. News from the guinea pig grapevine suggests that whatever it is, we won't know until it's way too late. See? You see, we're all canaries in the coal mine on this one.
Robert Downey Jr.'s other films include Good Night and Good Luck, Chaplin, Wonder Boys, Less Than Zero, The Pickup Artist, Shortcuts, and Natural Born Killers. He won a Golden Globe for his performance on the television show Ally McBeal. But for several years, his talent was a hostage to his drug addiction. In 2002, after several comebacks that were cut short by drugs, and after spending time in prison and court-ordered rehab, Downey was finally clear of all legal constraint and was cast in the film adaptation of Dennis Potter's BBC miniseries The Singing Detective. He played a detective novelist afflicted with a crippling form of psoriasis, which covered his entire body in scabs and peeling skin and brought on high fevers and hallucinations. The film came out in 2003. That's when he spoke with Terry.
I'm wondering if it's not too personal to ask if you related to this character from your own confinements, either in rehab or in prison.
It's interesting because, again, I kind of got it more as we went along. And, you know, I'm not a ignoramus or anything, but it's kind of like if you took somebody out of, like, Folsom and then said, now we're shooting a prison movie. You know what I mean? They'd be like, oh, I know what you're talking about, I think. And then pretty soon they'd be like, well, let's see, when he says chow time, how should I react? You know, I mean, it's like, for me, I was focused mostly on what was right in front of me.
Right.
Which was, you know, a big challenge, a high degree of difficulty. And retrospectively, I now have found it somewhat cathartic, particularly when I see the audience watch the film and get it, and then I can relax a little bit, and then I watch it and I start to get it, not just as a film, but as a parallel, you know, to my own life.
I think that's interesting that you'd see that as a viewer. But you didn't consciously try to work with it as an actor.
Well, I did it at certain points. But, you know, for instance, I've never been tarred and feathered that I remember.
That's good.
And yet that was the physical feeling of the makeup, the way it was applied, the way that after you put on the prosthesis, there was a lot of paint and gooey substances on top. And then over that, there was a gelatin shellac that was applied, dried at high heats, and then cracked to mirror the flaking effect of the dead skin. So, I mean, that was just ridiculous. You know, but I'm not used to being uncomfortable in that way. So it was kind of new, somewhat.
Some people say that they think that being incarcerated actually, you know, saved their lives because it forced them to be without drugs. Other people say, well, you get drugs in prison. But, you know, I've heard both sides of that.
You know, whatever floats your boat, some people are so afraid of being in the box that that fear works for them. Some people are so afraid of being in the box again that that works. I've never really had much of a fear of either. You know, it didn't work for me at all. And it could never work for me because, you know, I like a good box.
You were okay being, you know, being alone and confined?
Well, it was awful, but, yeah, I wasn't, you know, It's not like I was like, I can't take this anymore. Oh, God, why me? I was like, oh, I'm in a box. This sucks. What am I going to read today?
You always strike me as a really brave actor, someone really willing to take risks. And a lot of the personalities that you've played in your films are those really edgy personalities, people who are obsessive, or they're liars, or they're just, they're kind of over the top in some way or the other. Mm-hmm. And the roles that I think of, the movies I think of there are Pickup Artist, Two Girls and a Guy, Wonder Boys. I just think it's so much fun watching you on screen. There's a scene, God, I forget what the song is, but there's a scene in Two Girls and a Guy, which is a James Toback film, in which you're basically lying to everybody in your life in that movie. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where you break out into song, and I'm forgetting what the song is.
Oh, Jackie Robinson's You Don't Know Me?
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that scene a little bit?
Oh, yeah. He's he goes into his apartment. The two gals.
This is it, yeah.
Philandering or hiding in the loft closet. And he gets home and he calls both of them on the telephone and tells them they're the only one. And you know, we know that that's about to blow up. But he's still thinking everything's cool. And he goes over to his piano microphone and sings to himself in kind of a less than serious way.
Why don't we hear that part of the scene?
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell.
You think you know me well?
No, you don't know. No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night, afraid and shy. Honey, I let my chance go by, the chance you might have loved me too.
It's a really fun scene, I have to say. And you've been singing more since then. You sang on Ally McBeal. You sing the final song in The Singing Detective, even though your character is lip-syncing in the credit sequence at the end. You're actually singing. Do you like to sing?
I've always liked it. And I always encourage people to say, I can't really sing. I go, you know what? It's fundamentally impossible for the human body to not be able to produce, hold, carry, and interact in complex ways with tones and music and all that stuff. It's our nature. 3.5 billion years of DNA saying, sing.
So how old were you when you got your first agent?
I was doing a play at the Colonnades across from the Public Theater when I wasn't bussing tables at the Central Falls, right down the street on West Broadway, and I was in a play called Fraternity about SMU, and someone came to see one of the other actors in it who wound up having an interesting career himself, and they asked if they could talk to me and said that they'd be interested in signing me. And the funny thing was, I really was working as hard as I could when I did that little play, and I didn't expect much out of it, but I'd get there an hour and a half before curtain, and I was like 16 or 17. I would do yoga, and I would run over the scenes, and I would go out and touch the lights, and you know, all this kind of really ethereal approach to doing a little like 60-seat theater who gives a damn play, you know. But I needed that, and I ritualized it, and it's funny, you know. It's almost like I never have worked as hard since in a certain fashion as I did right at the very, 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 very beginning in theater.
Who were you hoping to become? Was there an actor or a certain type of actor that you think you were modeling yourself on?
Let's see. Later on, when I was already up and running, Sean Penn was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I was hugely affected by Matt Dillon, Ralph Macchio,
mm-hmm.
Scott Baio. You know, all the guys who seemed like, wow, look at him go. And then when I got out to California, the whole Brat Pack thing was already sealed up and rolling, and I thought they were all amazing.
What about older films? Did you watch a lot of older films when you were getting started?
Well, let me put it this way. I remember my dad bringing me to see, like, Slaughterhouse-Five and Le Grand Bouff and Truffaut movies. And I mean, it's amazing the things that I saw before I was 10 years old.
Wait, isn't Le Grand Bouff the movie where they eat themselves to death? Is that Le Grand Bouff?
Exactly. Wasn't that great?
Oh, I hated that film.
It was awful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember the scene where the couple was making love and someone's knocking at the door and the guy says, I'm coming. And I was like, why is that funny? God, I don't get anything. And then as often as not, we'd be watching other movies and my dad would just stand up and say, we're gone. I'd be like, why? He goes, oh, this thing's scuffing. And we didn't even make it through the opening credits. He didn't like the visual and we were splitting.
Well, that might have been helpful, though. Was he always pointing out these things that you never would have noticed as a child if you didn't have a filmmaker father to point them out?
Sure. And but aside from that, I was given a very, very specific education. You know, I mean, Preston Sturges was, you know, we named our Yorkshire Terrier after him. Kubrick's our cat. You know, I mean, it was like everything was about great directors in our household. And writers. I didn't think of anything else as a life. I mean, I knew I had friends whose fathers were doctors or worked down at, the sporting goods store, which is great because I wanted a BB gun. You know, I mean, it was like, it just seemed like, and I have to credit my folks with this, you know, it was a very organic approach to something technical, artistic, and kind of otherworldly. And then my mother is a very, very gifted actress and singer and comedian. And my father was primarily a writer who decided that he should direct what he wrote to kind of keep it true to his original intent. And it's an amazing director, very influential director. And, but more importantly than that was I had this sense of, if you wanted to do something that seemed like only a small percentage of people on Earth were chosen to do that, you could do whatever you wanted. My dad always says this. He goes, anybody can act. Hardly anybody can direct. And nobody can write. So in descending order, I'm kind of in, you know, I get the bronze medal. You know, but...
Well, your father, Robert Downey, is most famous for his film Putney Swope, which was a comedy about the advertising industry and about race. What impact did it have on your life when that film became popular? How old were you then?
I was 3 or 4 when it came out. I think what it was is there was a huge reaction to it, particularly from, you know, the 10 or 12 guys, you know, that are my dad's age who've really kind of formed the artistic element of Maverick filmmaking since. And so he was very much revered and hailed as this just, you know, super innovative guy. And so the only impact it really had on me was I knew that my dad was something really, really, really special. And I remember this day that he was wearing a Superman shirt because that was kind of like the kind of shirts you were getting down on Bleecker Street instead of the NYPD shirts or, you know, whatever now it is. And I just remember, there's my dad, and he's wearing a Superman shirt. And he had a throne in his bedroom.
He had a throne in his bedroom?
You know, imagine what year it was, too. We're talking, you know, this is like 33 years ago. You know, everyone had a throne in their bedroom.
Of course.
Come on, you know, or they had the glass beads going into the kitchen and, you know, the kitchen had a big, like, smiley face hubcap on the wall. I mean, it was great. Everyone's cat was named something like George Washington or Kubrick or whatever.
So I'm getting the picture that you're really like the child of hippie parents. Very successful film world isn't, hippie parents.
Isn't that funny? Because they were actually squares.
Really?
But the same way that, you know, I might be considered a square by people who really know me. And then before I go out to this premiere tonight, I'll put on like, you know, a Helmut Lang shirt and a pair of cool glasses and a, you know, somebody else's jacket that I have to return in a week. And it's like, whoa, look at him. He's mod. You know, no, I'm not. I'm a total nerd. I just clean up nice once in a while.
So, was there a lot of structure in your life when you were growing up?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was a structure. There was a structure, all right. Kind of like, yeah, that's how complexes are created, out of structures.
So, really, was there like discipline and structure, or were you pretty free to do whatever?
I went to school, you know. Went to school. I was in judo. I was in chorus. I was in drama. And that's all I got.
You dropped out of school at the age of 17, right?
Yes, gladly.
Right.
Things had gotten to the point where mom and dad split up. Dad's going back east. He said, you can stay or you can go. And then he left. And I was like, why am I staying with a buddy of mine from high school in a garage in the Venice Canals? I got to get out of here. I got to go to New York. So I went back to New York where I was from. And then I started working in theater and kind of put a little career together. And I couldn't have done both. I couldn't have finished out the school year, waited till summertime, and then gone back east. I wouldn't have made it. I didn't have any dough. I had a job at Thrifty's, but all of us got fired because two of us were stealing. And, you know, it was time to move on.
So did you go for, like, acting training, or did you just go right into auditions?
Kind of both. I realized quickly that I was never going to get a Casio commercial or a Dr. Pepper spot because I couldn't bring myself to say when the lady comes in and goes, you're the Pied Piper and everyone wants to be like you. Now let's get the next group in. And I was like, oh my God, I got to go. No, you don't have to go. Come in here. We're doing the auditions. I was like, no, I swear to God, I don't know how to sell a little keyboard. But I learned, you know that little movie out, Todd Graff's movie Camp?
Oh, I love that film.
I went to Stage Door Manor.
Did you really?
Sure.
This is a summer camp for the performing arts.
Yes, in Loch Sheldrake it was initially, and Todd Graff and I were in, you know, plays and learned stuff. And
one of the funny things about camp, about the movie, is that they do these, like, overly sophisticated, ambitious, like, Sondheim musicals. It's 12-year-olds. Were you in a position like that?
Join us now, we're on a marathon. Jacques Brel is alive and well, living in Paris. Jules Pfeiffer presents. I was like, who are all these people? It's like, shut up, Lyta Newport. Come here, kid. It was great. Never forget it. And then there was regional theater, and then there was off-Broadway and musicals. And so, you know, in my own way, you know, when I'm out west, you know, there's very few people who were afforded the kind of training I was. Like, what did you do? Well, I surfed and I went to Baja and I went to Club Med and got some drink beads and then I, like, did a movie. You know, it's like I had it a little different than that.
Well, I really want to wish you good luck and I really thank you for doing the interview. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, this was good.
Robert Downey Jr. co-stars in the new Richard Linklater movie, A Scanner Darkly. He spoke with Terry in 2003. A year after that interview was broadcast, Downey put out a CD, mostly of his own songs, called The Futurist. He also included this song, written by Charlie Chaplin, with Alan Broadbent on piano and Charlie Hayden on bass. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and make tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. Light up your face with gladness. Hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear may be ever so near, that's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find